is turned on.
Oh God, let's go.
Da, 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 go.
This is why I can't have relationships. And
or relations.
That's once good, again. Man.
That's the hammer.
3, 2, 1, go.
Oh, no, that stays in regard. Hello and welcome once again to Lickman and Rizoff live, in air quotes, at Grassroots Tavern. As always, I'm John Lickman, contributor to The House Next Door, and a sad, sad man.
As always, I'm Vadim, John's loyal lover and sidekick.
We have current House Next Door editor, Keith Ulick, here to watch over us and make sure we don't do anything particularly awful.
A little less drunk than last time, and hopefully going to set some of us out so I can let the other speakers talk.
And tonight we have two very special guests.
Yay!
I suppose so.
We have Odie Hendrickson, contributor to The House Next Door, menace to society and savior of humankind.
Jack of all trades and master of everyone.
And also, House Next Door founder, editor emeritus, which I think I butchered in saying.
Emeritus.
Latin.
Emeritus.
And writer-director, Matt Zoller Seitz.
Hello.
So tonight, I guess we'll start out with a very fun topic. Speed Racer came out on Friday. It may have done $15 million. It may have made $18 million. No one really knows because Warner Brothers may have been cooking the books.
It was posited as making 20.2, which was about the same as...
A $200,000 victory over what happens in Vegas.
Which was about the same as what happened in Vegas, which they predicted was 20.1. But it turned out that what happened in Vegas made 20.2 and Speed Racer made 18-point-something.
There have actually been a number of examples of this thing happening. I can't think of the specific one. But over the last few years, there have been a lot of studios. I think every studio has been busted doing this at some point.
I know, and I love the indignance people are showing right now as if it's the first time it's ever happened.
Well, but I understand why they do it, because there's no bragging rights in being number two.
Yeah.
You know,
or three.
Yeah.
It's even worse.
Yeah.
But do you guys think this is after the whole fact that Iron Man has dominated and is now considered the summer blockbuster?
It's early. You know, Iron Man could easily be usurped by Carrie Bradshaw and Samantha and her rabbit punani.
Yeah.
That's the only movie for women.
Well, how many have seen Speed Racer aside from me?
I saw it.
Not saw me. It now, finally.
I actually started to doze off during the trailer, so I thought that was a bad sign. It was just something about it that made me sleepy. I couldn't quite put my finger on it.
Well, I talked about it last week, so what did the people who've seen it now think?
Well, Rex Reed said it was like watching 2 hours of Fuchsia vomit. I went to see it because I had nothing else to do, and it was like Rainbow Bright's ass exploded all over the screen. It was just so many colors, and I think if you're high, you wouldn't even have to be high. I felt like I was on LSD. The colors. And that I want to point out that Rex Reed had said that Christina Ricci looked like a finger me doll.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, this is a criticism?
And this is an observation that Rex Reed would make?
Well, you should read his review. It's hilarious.
I've read it.
He's like, yeah, she's a finger me doll, looks like Lulu. And I'm like, this is a complaint, Myron Breckenridge?
Vadim?
I did go to it high. And then it wore off halfway through, and it was the same movie. Like, I didn't mind at all.
Nothing changed, right?
It was bright, and it was shiny, and there was a part where John Goodman beat up a ninja, and then Christina Ricci is like, is that a ninja? It's like, more like a nunja. It's like, you know, if I had kids, which thank God I don't, then I'd rather them watch this than Spy Kids, because they're exactly the same level of garishness and kind of, like, non-offensive, retarded, over-the-top, everything happening, except... This one isn't ass ugly. Because this one isn't ass ugly, it's not made by my arch nemesis, Robert Rodriguez.
Spy Kids is a much better movie.
No, Spy Kids is the movie made by Robert Rodriguez, who growing up in Austin, I heard every day for like 18 years is the savior of all film everywhere and has single-handedly revolutionized digital filming, which may be true, but I still don't like his movies. And, Spy Kids
I highly dispute that, but go on.
Well, aside from Once Upon a Time
at least
Mexico,
Spy Kids was about 45 minutes short. Yeah, Speed Racer was like Gone with the Wind for kids.
I didn't even realize that it was that long, because I was just saying, like, are they really going to structure this whole thing around the race? It's like they actually did that? Why not? Let's do it.
Well, this kind of gets into an interesting issue that, the whole, starting with The Phantom Menace, there started to be some talk of this idea of a movie that was somewhere between being a live action and being a cartoon. Mm-hmm. And the question is, are there any movies that have done that I won't say successfully, because some people will never like that kind of movie, but in a way that was at least interesting and defensible.
You mean use digital animation?
Yeah, where what you're looking at is as far as, you know, it looks like it's probably not real. I mean, and they're really not making a whole lot of effort to hide that.
Well,
where most of the movie is not supposed to be in the realm of the recognizably real.
Well, to be honest, Speed Racer.
Yeah, Speed Racer's aggressively.
Yeah, it is. It looks like a live-action cartoon.
In my opinion, I think it's a very deliberate aesthetic choice. Whereas I argued last week in the Matrix movies, I felt like the digital stuff in that was basically used as a lazy way to extend things for a lot of it. Whereas here, I felt like whether in putting aside like or dislike sorts of things, I think the movie can be defended purely on the level of aesthetic choice and aesthetic intent and auteurist intent, in a sense. I think the Wachowskis know exactly what they're doing. What Joel Silver thinks he's financing, I have no fucking clue.
I don't know why anyone financed it. That was decision.
I mean, it's fascinating because
it was it's what they thought of as a pre-sold property.
Right.
And for some bizarre reason, anything that has been made once in any form gets greenlit, and I don't understand why that is. Like, you look at something like, you know, Sergeant Bilko
or Bewitched.
It's made into a movie.
What 12-year-old knows what Bewitched is?
Right. Who's going to go to the theater to see that, who's of the age that they would go to a theater on opening weekend? It seems demographically dumb.
I hate to go see Sergeant Bilko, and I thought it was great.
I knew what Sergeant Bilko was because I wasn't 8 when it came out.
Right, but I mean, you know, I feel like Speed Racer does that. I feel like I'll be interested to see what Spielberg's take on Tintin will be, because I'm really looking forward to what he's going to do with that.
I thought 300 and Sin City were both movies that were, I think, got mostly mixed to negative reviews. And
yeah.
I thought they were really kind of interesting, and they weren't, you know, the problem I had with them was they were so unvaried in their tone and their rhythm that they got boring.
Well, that could also be in part due to Frank Miller.
Who is a hack and who treats Nora like a 12-year-old boy.
I guess nobody's looking forward to the Spirit then.
I was looking forward to the Spirit until I saw the one sheet and then I saw how he was filming it.
Yeah.
And the fact that the entire monologue is him doing My city is...
Yeah.
My sister, my lover, my secret teacher.
Yeah. She is crying to me.
And Sam, I mean, I saw a picture of Sam Jackson today in like a fur coat with white leather gloves.
As the octopus, yeah.
Does he have messed up hair? Because that's a staple of Sam Jackson.
He's playing the octopus and Nick Fury. I mean, it's like...
Well, Sam Jackson looks the same now in every film, so it doesn't
matter. No, his hair is always different. You know, he had that Frederick Douglass shit going on in that.
Anakin, don't believe him.
I'm yelling.
Oh,
I don't
my
know
God.
Why.
Richard Roundtree. Chef.
Oh, yeah.
In Speed Racer.
That was great.
Yeah.
That.
Mighty have fallen.
Mighty
is debatable.
He raises the level of the movie whenever he's on screen.
He does.
As like the old time racer who just sort of magically appears in one scene and then ends up as an announcer later in the film and has like, you know, just random announcer lines like he's practically Fred Willard in Best in Show or something.
That's what the movie needed was Fred Willard.
When you have Richard Roundtree doing Fred Willard in Best in Show in Speed Racer, then
it kind of makes me want to see it. If only for 10 minutes.
It's bizarre. Yeah.
There's also the ethnic stereotype announcers who I really enjoyed. Like
God, the Wachowskis and their fetish for multiculturalism.
It was beyond. It was like three newscasters like in conference with Japanese.
They brought Rain into it. Asian pop star.
Yeah.
Korean.
Who could sell out Madison Square Garden for roughly a week.
Wow.
And he is my my Korean gay man crush.
He's your kimchi.
Okay, well, you've opened the door.
Okay.
Who would everyone at this table go gay for?
Really? We're going to play that game?
Yes.
Jeez. The list is lengthy. Dead or alive is my question.
Let's stick to alive.
Okay.
We're not getting into necrophilia, homosexuality yet.
Probably Richard Gere, because I think he'd know what he was doing and he'd be gentle.
I have a lame choice of David Bowie and Rain, so you put in like two of the pop sandwiches.
Daniel Day-Lewis probably goes without saying.
Didn't you say Christian Bale at one time?
I've
Christian
abandoned
Bale's
my boy!
There, no doubt. Yeah, I got a major man crush on Christian Bale, no doubt.
Vadim?
My high school doppelganger, Jason Schwartzman, back when we both looked like Max Fisher.
So basically, Vadim wants to fuck himself.
This is part of that narcissism and arrogance we've been hearing so much about.
And I'm not surprised.
Oh, you poor boy. We'll turn that around.
Well, I guess I'd have to fuck myself too. Cuba.
Because on Gawker, they were guessing that Cuba was one of the people who was outed in that book that the guy just wrote.
I have that whole list of by the gay Deadpool, is what I call it, where all this list of gay people and everybody's come. Yeah, like who's coming out. Like, you know, they have Doogie was on it before he came out, and Tom Cruise is number one. They got Queen Latifah on it. I'm probably going to get sued for this.
Wait, Queen Latifah?
We'll get sued for this.
Well, I've heard that Cuba Gooding Jr. and John Lithgow are on the list of highly employed actors who just like to be naked, either in a movie or otherwise. They're just very comfortable with themselves in that way, exactly. Even if you're not.
And you say the Deadpool, and it makes me think that the first line in the Deadpool, the Dirty Harry movie, is... Get off my ass.
Exactly. It is.
That's the first line.
It is the first line.
It's like the credits, and then it cuts to Clint, and he's driving along, and he looks in the rearview mirror, like just sort of does that sort of laconic slight turn of the head down, look at the mirror, sort of eye light here, Joan Crawford style, and he goes, get off my ass.
Yep. You know, Eastwood has been so totally canonized that I think we forget how incredibly disreputable he was for the longest time. Like, I was watching Sudden Impact on cable not too long ago.
Yeah.
There's actually a moment where, you know, the little dog, the little pit bull, Meathead, that Dirty Harry acquires in that movie? It's actually, the dog, like, farts in the movie, and they actually have a moment where, like, as a punchline to a scene, they cut to a close-up of the dog's ass as he farts.
Yeah.
In Sudden Impact.
I thought, like, at the Oscars, you know, when they give him his special award, like, that should be the first thing in the clip. There's the close-up of Meathead popping one, you know.
Yes, and then him getting his leg cut off and the Beguiled.
I love the Beguiled. That movie is
That is just a messed up little movie. Well, he's doing the new Dirty Harry. He's doing a new one.
I wrote about that.
He's doing a sixth Dirty Harry. No, Gran Torino is not the Dirty Harry movie. And I was thinking about, you know, Charles Bronson in Death Wish 6, where since they got finished, they didn't have any more of his relatives to rape and murder. They start going after his pets. And then he, like, shoots a guy with a cannon that says, this one for Fluffy. Blah!
You killed my Muffy.
That's right.
There was a clip that we linked to that showed all of the people that he had killed in the Death Wish movies in chronological order. It was kind of incredible.
It is.
Actually, whoever did that is a sort of a low genius.
No, because what's fascinating about it is you can see the moral conflict in the first few kills.
Yeah. Right.
Because the original Death Wish actually has some sort of, it seems like,
at least they're pretending.
Some kind of conscience, whether it's believable or not, but at least it seems to be there. And then you get to, like, Death Wish 3, and he's, like, blowing guys out of windows with bazookas.
Yeah.
Was the one where he fought the crack house? Was
that
four?
That's
the
fifth
one.
Is that four or
the
five?
Death Wish 4 is the message of death or some shit.
He gets older and grayer and craggier to the point where, like, there's other action heroes hiding in his face. You know? It's, like, unbelievable.
He just stares at the criminals and he turns them to stone because he's so damn old.
I think we're going to employ the no more
stop clock. Yes.
And move on to topic number two. Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is coming out soon.
I already have my tickets.
So what do we think? The internet has had its own little backlash where Anna Cool has been all blah, blah, blah. And then we found out that Anna Cool's little reviewers are in fact theater chain owners.
Exactly.
Who are saying...
Really?
Yeah, who have said that they have been disparaging the film in order to get it for cheaper.
Wow.
So it has been revealed that those reviews are kind of...
Mostly the people that do any cool reviews are either people that walk in off the street or they are the theater chain owners.
That totally makes sense.
It makes sense.
When I was at the Dallas Observer and I couldn't get into screenings in the way that Dallas Morning News people could, one of the ways that I would try to get reviews for big movies in opening day was I would go to friends I knew who were theater managers and ask them to take me as their guest to exhibitor screenings.
Right, right.
And in some cases, these were like little art house type people, you know, like who were never going to show Interview with the Vampire, which is one of the ones that I snuck into. So I'm not at all surprised to hear that, because there's all sorts of people who would, you know, be going to these movies early, you know, and it's not particularly resourceful. They would have gone anyway.
And I don't know whether it's a It's kind of weird to see that little veneer pull back and that we finally get to see who the main Brona. Oh, I mean, come on.
It's shocking that many of Annie Cole's sources are just completely unreliable and have their own self-interest.
Surprise!
I know, Vadim, it's like you've grown up with that.
She's got to start, we've really got to start videotaping this podcast so everyone can see the evil and yet sexy looks that John and Vadim give each other. Keep going.
It's revolting.
So, aside from all that, I'm actually pretty excited for Indiana Jones 4. I mean, this is going to be the first one that I will see that has been on VHS, that has been on USA. And the first time I've actually seen Harry. I mean, also the same excitement I kind of had when I saw Star Wars. It came back into the theaters and it was all, CGI enhanced. I was like, fuck, I'm seeing Star Wars in a movie theater. That's awesome.
Yeah, see, 89 was a big summer for me because that was Batman, the Burton original, and Last Crusade, which has since become, which really has always been my favorite indie movie. So I've seen Indy in the theater, and I kind of have a vivid memory of seeing it, too. I mean, did you see Raiders in the theater?
I saw all three of them in the theater.
Yeah. I know, you wrote about that. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, tell about the experiences in the theater, I guess.
When I went to see it, there was this girl that sat behind me, and the entire movie she kept saying, "Oh, that's so gross, that's disgusting." The
this
whole
is Raiders.
Movie, this is at Raiders.
Yeah.
And then when I went to see the Temple of Doom, the same girl was behind me. This big, beautiful black ghetto girl behind me saying, "That's disgusting." That's what she just went into overdrive on Temple of Doom. Everything was disgusting. And I'm like, "Did I see you last movie?"
Like the food is terrible in such small portions.
That's right, in such small portions, yes.
Yeah.
But and I left the movie theater, and as the one time I remember, the first time people applauded at the end of the movie at Raiders. Yeah. And I was like, they can't hear you in the damn screen. But I wanted to clap too, and it's the best time I've ever had at the movies.
That's the best kind of, for me, that's the reaction. Like, I live for that. Like, I live for that moment. Yeah. It's only happened a few times where people are applauding the filmmaking. It's not like a plot twist, like good guy gets one over on the bad guy. They're plotting the movie.
Right. It was over.
And man, what a feeling that is.
Yeah.
Oh,
well,
my God.
It's funny. For me, that happened in 93 with twice, but in different ways with Jurassic Park.
I knew you were going to say
Jurassic Park and Schindler's List.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Jurassic Park, it was, that's the last time I think I remember everyone in an audience being so in sync with something that it was just like perfect. Especially like the minute the raptor jumps out at Laura Dern to the end.
Yeah.
You know, it was like everybody, like when the raptor jumped up on the kitchen table and stuff in the kitchen. It was like you just. I remember the audience all went back in their seats
that,
and there was this one guy who probably was basically, I guess, was speaking for all of us, who just went,
yeah,
like two clap, and that's it.
Well, that's because that's all he could manage. Because then the next thing comes at you,
right? Yeah, exactly. So that's, and then in Schindler's List, of course, what happened there, and I've only seen it once, and I probably should revisit it at some point, but it's basically, maybe not the opposite, but similar in the sense that, you know, that thing just sort of got everybody so worked up that by the end, everybody was tearing in the theater.
The
and crying,
guy next
audibly,
to me was crying like he
audibly,
was at a funeral.
Audibly crying, and absolutely nobody, not a single person, got up until all the credits had rolled and the lights came up. And that was like, and that's two Spielbergs in 93 when that happened.
Well, yeah,
and it sort
tends
of like,
to work that
and,
way.
And it's interesting, and then I recall like the next few years always looking for something to kind of repeat that experience, never really getting it, and then seeing The Lost World and having a very mixed reaction in the audience to that film, and then kind of realizing, I don't think that is ever going to be recaptured again.
Well,
and
maybe it will, it just depends on the movie. I mean, I've had that happen in a few movies, including some Spielberg movies. And actually, Jurassic Park was, well, not the applause thing, but, you know, Spielberg has a knack for just grabbing your heart and going, yeah, and just squeezing the shit out of it.
Yeah.
You know, really, there's almost nobody alive who has that ability. In Jurassic Park, I had that kind of reaction. It was actually during the T-Rex attack, and I'll preface this by saying that I'm notorious. Ask any critic who has ever worked in the same city with me, and they will tell you I'm notorious for being really, really, really vocal during movies. Like, and you know this. I mean,
yes,
really,
sure.
Next to me, it's embarrassing.
It's
like I've got Tourette's or something. And Jurassic Park, the T-Rex attack, and of course Spielberg does that horror movie thing where he kind of goes right up to the edge of boredom and maybe crosses over, and you're kind of going, this is boring. when are they going to show the dinosaurs? And then he hits you with this all-out assault. And the T-Rex attack, you know, that sequence in the movie was so unrelenting. It was absolutely so unrelenting that I actually was shielding my face, screaming in my seat. And, like, it was just so... I was so into it. I felt like the T-Rex was, like, tearing through the roof of that truck trying to get me. And I was actually shrieking like a little girl at one point. Like, wah, wah, wah!
Where's and the then, goat?
And then he does that. And then, of course, Spielberg does that thing where it's, like, the noise gets louder and louder and louder and louder and louder. And then suddenly it just stops.
Yeah, because...
And it's, like, dead silence. And then you get to hear the audience going, wah, wah, wah.
Yeah,
because,
no, because the last part of that scene is the T-Rex like,
and then there's like a hard cut.
And then it just goes right to cut and Sam Jackson at the computer being like, I'm going to talk very quietly and techno babble on the album.
Exactly. And so when that happened, I was in mid-shriek, like mid-girly man shriek, turned sideways in my chair, curled up in a fetal position, and I go, and then, you know, everybody kind of looks at me, and I looked over, and next to me was this 5-year-old girl staring at me, and she goes, Mister... Are you okay?
And see, it's for this exact reason why I hate to go off on the anime tangent, but why Steven Spielberg will never, ever touch Ghost in the Shell aside from as a producer credit.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean...
I'm sorry, Vadim, to bring that up, but...
Well, Ghost in the Shell was done definitively with Innocence. That's like one of the best anime movies I've ever seen.
Reasoning that Spielberg will direct it, I mean, that's the same as when Spielberg said, oh, I'm going to come in for Transformers, and Takara goes, yeah, great, no, take our product. He's like, yep, I'm gonna actually executive produce it or something.
Give it to Michael Bay.
But Steven Spielberg does not direct anything. He can't call it a short hit.
Well,
he plans everything so meticulous.
Well, let's though talk about
spinning into a paranoid Steven Spielberg session.
Yes, we may, but I think we should get out of it very quickly and go back to Indiana Jones.
To Crystal Skull. So let's talk about Crystal Skull and what the expectations are, I guess, here.
Evil psychic communists.
Evil psychic communists.
The aliens from Third Encounter of the Third...
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Apparently, the Ark is in Area 51 now.
Right. Yeah, well, we saw the close-up in the trailer. It said Roswell.
Right.
One of the crates. So it's not exactly like he's hiding it.
Shia LaBeouf in an homage to the Wild One.
Yeah.
And that awesome shot of Indy picking up his hat with the shadow, which is pure Janusz Kaminski, and not Douglas Slocum in any way.
That's not true, though. They have a shot very much like that in Raiders.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah,
you're right.
In the
I'm
tavern.
Sorry, Douglas. My bad.
Yeah, or you should direct that, I think, Heavenward.
Heavenward.
Is he alive?
No, Douglas is alive.
Oh,
he's retired.
Oh, he's retired, really?
I think.
All right.
He's just retired.
I'm notorious for killing people that aren't dead.
They should have brought his ass out of retirement for this, but that's a whole other issue.
He doesn't want to. Like, Sean Connery didn't want to come out of retirement.
Okay.
Really? Did he not want to come out, or was he just like...
Well, after coming out that first...
I want to have hair, and I want to beat up people half my age.
John Hurt read the script, and basically has more or less expressed in his between the lines way disdain for it, you know. But he did it anyway. So I mean, I'm sure Connery would have done it too if he wanted to come out.
I have this bad feeling in the pit of my stomach that it's going to be like my reaction was to Last Crusade, which is I was happy to be there. Like, I was happy to see those characters again, and there were parts of it that I really loved, but it didn't give me the overwhelming adrenaline rush that the first two did. You know, and it was probably a different kind of movie. Maybe it wasn't intended to do that, but
and plus, you're older.
And when
that's true. But I wasn't that much older. Last Crusade. And that same summer, The Abyss practically gave me a heart attack. And that, I don't think that was half as good a movie as Last Crusade.
Yeah, but the older thing, the older observation is interesting because I think that sort of happened to me with The Lost World. You know, that kind of reaction where I just remembered the original Jurassic Park so fondly, and then I go to this. You know, and it's a much darker movie. Well, I've actually come to kind of admire the sequel anyway, because I think visually it's a much more interesting film than what Dean Cundey did in the original Jurassic Park. But it still has the stupid, you know, gymnastics scene.
Oh, that's dumb. There's a lot of dumbness.
There's a lot of dumb stuff in The Lost World, and yet at the
same
time...
But he kills the dog. You see, Spielberg is notorious for these horrible things.
But it kills the pit bull. And I will say that the better thing that came out earlier was in Mars Attacks when Tim Burton killed the golden retriever.
Right.
That's what you need to do. If you kill the pit bull, it's like, fine.
Disney kills old Yeller.
Yeah, but didn't he also have a bunch of tiny little dinosaurs eating a kid in that?
Admittedly, yes. Off screen.
But nevertheless...
it's there. It's pretty dark.
Yeah. Well, and he killed the girl in the red dress in Schindler's
List. Well, the larger
little boy on
the
raft.
I don't know if it's really that much of a problem, but the larger problem for me with the Jurassic Park films and the Indiana Jones films is that apart from their thrill ride aspect, they don't have a whole lot going for them. I don't think.
Well, except in Last Crusade, in my opinion, but you know.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I can see that.
Now, as far as Crystal Skull, well, I kind of felt like the story ended nicely with Last Crusade, to tell the truth.
I agree with that.
Riding off into the sunset.
Well,
so.
It is, but then again, they left themselves an opening because this one is flipping the father-son dynamic. So that might be intriguing to see, and him being basically in sort of like a more buff version of the Sean Connery part.
Yeah, yeah.
And Spielberg has that father issue,
but, His
father
movies,
desperation issue.
If there are not daddy movies in the script, he puts one in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, though, it is written by David Koepp, who never met a bad punchline. He couldn't, recycle.
It could have been worse. It could have been written by Willard Huck and Gloria Katz, but never mind.
Yeah.
Oh, no, come on. One of these days I have to defend Howard the Duck, but,
Why? Why and how?
You do, I'm going to get another drink.
Matt, you were actually talking about what you're up to now with the puppet film. So would you mind speaking a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. I'm just in the process of storyboarding the thing, and it's got over 1,000 shots in it, and most of it is green screen or rear screen projection stuff. So there's like multiple layers to be accounted for in each part of it. And it's just going to take a long time to do. But right now I'm contracting different people to make the puppets. And there's main characters and supporting characters, and there's also these sort of utility and field characters who are kind of featureless, and you can put different eyes and noses and mouths on them, and they can kind of play. They're like character actors, basically. To save you the trouble of doing, creating a puppet who's only going to be in one scene, that sort of thing.
It's the Ed Harris puppet.
And it's going to be a longer process than I thought. And in fact, what we're doing now, the plan has changed somewhat. Originally, the plan was to make this thing as a reel, this feature-length film as a reel, and then try to go out and raise money to start a children's entertainment company. But instead, we're going to just try to do the two things simultaneously. So we're actually going to be meeting with investors while we're in Dallas and, showing them a plan and whipping out the puppet, as they say, and trying to convince them to part with some of their money and start a little company.
So it's the kind of feature that could be shot in piecemeal, in a sense?
No, it's going to be shot all at once, and it's going to be shot at the same time as some little, shorts. Basically the idea is to kind of showcase these characters. It's a character-based company, it's like a repertory company of puppets, essentially. It's like, Looney Tunes and Muppets is sort of the model for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
And was it, Star Wars-based, or what is the...
It's a variety of things. There's a Star Wars parody in there, there's some kind of Sesame Street-type stuff, and it's just it's a variety of things aimed at different types of...
Will you be looking at The Electric Company, which is now reshooting on the Lower East Side?
Really? I didn't know that. Oh, my God.
I love The Electric Company.
PBS is bringing back The Electric Company. And
with Morgan Freeman?
Not with Morgan.
With Sam Jackson and the Morgan
Jackson
Freeman part.
Yeah, I'm easy motherfucking reader.
Yeah,
easy reader. And then we'd finally do those things that we used to do as kids, when they have the silhouettes and they're like, boom, that. We would just do it with curses. So now they can actually do them with curses.
So here's the messed up part. They're filming it on the Lower East Side and...
It's like rent.
Chelsea, I think. It's Lower East Side and Chelsea of all the weird places.
It's
brought to you by the letters H,
Brought to you by the letters AIDFHIV.
And by the number 5.
At some point, there has to be a place to appreciate the genius of Cookie Monster. Have you ever watched any Cookie Monster shorts?
I love Cookie Monster.
Cookie Monster is I think he's up there with Laurel and Hardy, that guy. It's really hilarious. There's one, in fact, my 4-year-old, I got all these YouTube clips and I put them on a playlist, so when I'm cooking dinner, he just sits in and watches Cookie Monster, and he's memorized these sketches now, and sometimes he'll be walking down the street quoting certain Cookie Monster sketches verbatim, and there's one of them where Cookie Monster goes into a library, and he says, "Me want cookies," and the librarian says, "I'm sorry, we don't have any cookies here. This is a library. If you want a book, we have plenty of books." And he goes, "We have chocolate chip cookies." And it just kind of goes on from there. He just won't accept the fact that no cookies are available. And, it finally gets to the point where, of course, every Cookie Monster sketch is the same. He's basically a junkie who's being denied his books, right? And he just gets more and more frenzied, he can't contain himself. And then he says, the librarian's getting more frustrated. And he says, "We don't have cookies. Only books." Pause. The Cookie Monster.
here? Just give me the cookies. He goes, we don't have any cookies. He goes, oh, why you deny me?
Yeah, my favorite is still when they did Shaft with Cookie Monster, and he came out with all these gold chains on like Isaac Hayes in 71. He's got a beard. He's got these three Muppet chicks behind him, and then he points to the music, and it comes on, and it's like Shaft. And it's like, cookies!
Can you dig it?
You have to find that on YouTube.
I gotta find that. I don't think I've seen that one.
I have a clip tomorrow on Links for the Day that I hope you appreciate if you haven't seen.
Which one?
It's called Vader Blues. We're basically, it's the scene where Luke takes Vader's mask off at the end of Return of the Jedi, and you know, it plays out pretty normally and stuff as he's taking, just let me look on you with my own eyes, you know, takes the mask off and stuff, kind of, oh, looking. And then, you know, that thing in front of Vader kind of looks like a harmonica.
Yeah.
So then they start, they dub over a harmonica beat and edit the footage as if Vader's playing the harmonica and doing this bluegrass thing. So when the harmonica goes, you know, that's when he's like dying. He's like, and then he comes out here and all that, and then eventually they keep going back to like Luke, like, and they cut it around so it looks like he's like blinking and like what no stop that what, and then they do the reverse thing of him just putting the mask back on and stuff and stopping him from doing it, and then after he stops him from doing it with the mask on, you hear like a muffled harmonica going you have to see, it might be funnier in the description than it is in the video, but I think the video is pretty damn
funny.
It
reminds me of a friend of mine who was a sensitive singer-songwriter but was also really funny. He had this bit that he did. It was called The Lonesome Death of Robert Zimmerman. And he had the harmonica in his mouth and somebody like shoots him, and then it's like his entire death throes as conveyed through his breathing in the harmonica.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's like Once Upon a Time in the West when Henry Fonda
died. That's right.
Yeah. Which is a great like harmonica death scene. Any other great harmonica death scenes?
No, there weren't enough.
Actually, not true.
Yes.
Cabin Fever. Gets
that's
the
right.
harmonica shoved down, punches the harmonica down the guy's throat, and then Eli Roth goes, great, now that's great, do it.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
And I think that's.
And people say Eli Roth is worthless.
Well,
pretty much. Except for his little trailer in Grindhouse.
That's true. Thanksgiving's pretty great.
Yeah.
Although I remember I pissed him off once during a student interview because I asked him if he had been stealing from like Asian films for Hostel, namely Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, mm-hmm. and then. Audition,
right.
And he got incredibly pissed off with me.
So probably the answer is yes.
Well, the answer was yes.
Yeah, no, the answer is clearly yes. But then I said, "How? Like, would you ever want to remake Mikke?" He just flew off on a tangent. You can never remake Takashi Miike, etc., etc. I'm like, well,
you got to claim that shit. You got to claim it. You know, don't shy away from it.
Yeah,
it's my motto.
It's homage, which is French for ripoff.
I think DVDs ought to have a feature where every time that the filmmaker is ripped off a shot or a scene or something, there should be an Amazon link so you can just buy the movie.
There should just be pop-up video. This is like, this is from The Third Man.
Well, you can just watch him get killed in Southland Tales. So.
Oh, does he?
There's a brief scene when they're invading one of the communes, the Marxist commune, and they shoot a guy who's on a toilet, and it's Eli Roth.
How fitting.
Yeah. Shooting Eli Roth on a toilet. One of Southland Tales' more pointed commentaries.
Well, quickly, we'll use the No Murray Stop Clock and move on to the topic that Matt wants to talk about. 3D.
Yes.
3D.
Yeah, I've just been reading a lot of pieces online about 3D, particularly because Cameron is kind of...
Avatar?
Yeah, Cameron's out. He's out. He's talking about what he's doing and
James
kind
Cameron.
Of getting... Yeah, everybody getting... trying to get everybody hyped up about it. I'm just intrigued by it. And also, I went to a wedding this weekend where one of the guests was this guy who works for a firm in England, which apparently is one of the centers of 3D filmmaking technology, digital 3D. And he was talking about all the different projects that his company was working on or that other companies he knew of were working on, including a 3D basically, Lucas is taking all of the Star Wars films and making 3D versions of them, essentially scanning the 2D versions and then creating three, you know,
God,
a second.
You can't
leave
it alone.
You can't leave it alone.
Dimension. Yeah,
you
yeah.
can't leave it
it's
alone.
It's like a sore you can't stop picking.
They're on. Wow, that needs to be on the video box. It's like a sore he can't stop picking.
You're yeah. part of the Rebel Alliance and a traitor. Take her away.
Take her away. But I remember when 3D came back, and we had gone to see, there was a movie called Coming At You.
I saw that.
And yeah. you didn't even have to watch the movie, because at the end of the movie, they repeated every single 3D effect. Yeah. The movie was horrible.
Yeah.
And it was this Western that really sucked. But they had 3D effects, like a baby's butt coming into your face. And I remember the...
Did they have some cleavage in there?
They had cleavage, and they yeah. had knives and bats. I mean, for
was
no reason,
like a
there's a bat attack.
Or something, yeah.
And there's a spear attack, too. Yeah. It was like, what shit can we throw at the camera now? Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
And it's, it was awful.
My formative 3D experience was Freddy's Dead and Final Nightmare.
No, my formative was Andy Warhol's Frankenstein, but go ahead.
Oh, that was a good one.
Yes. But no, I and it was interesting, because I actually, before the movie came out, because I was a big Nightmare on Elm Street fan at that point.
Me too.
So I was saying, I kept hearing about how Freddy was going to die, and I was like, God, wouldn't it be cool, everyone, if Freddy, like, died in 3D? And then I opened the paper when it was the week before it came out, and it said, see Freddy die in 3D Freddy Vision.
Freddy Vision.
Freddy Vision, yeah. And it's a terrible movie.
It's
absolutely god-awful.
It's by Rachel Talalay.
Rachel Talalay. Mm-hmm. Yaphet Kotto is in it and everything, and gives and is like the Q
Yaphet
guy.
Kotto and
is the Q guy who gives the people the glasses. And I just have to say, as a tangent, I just saw The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe for the first time this week, and I have to say, I love that Santa Claus is Q in that movie. I think that's absolutely fucking brilliant. Okay, and Prince Caspian sucks, but anyway. but coming back to 3D, Freddy's Dead: The Final Nightmare. I mean, I remember going. And, you know, they gave out the 3D glasses there, and like, you know, and Yaphet Kotto was, like, the one who in the movie was, like, signaled to you, this is when you put on the 3D glasses and stuff, and, you know, he did it, and they were pretty crappy effects. I mean, it was just, the biggest one was, like, Freddy's burning head flying at you at the end and stuff and everything.
Right.
And I guess the other formative 3D experience, there are two others. One is Wings of Courage by the IMAX film
by
Jean-Jacques Annaud.
Which
I actually took my grandparents to see in high school. And just sort of
actually, the IMAX stuff is pretty pure 3D.
It's pretty great.
In the sense that it sort of goes back to the roots of what 3D was, which is throwing shit at your face.
Exactly.
But also, another great thing to see in 3D was the original 3D print of Dial M for Murder.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Which is Hitchcock does a much more interesting use of 3D in the sense that there is the, you know, coming at the camera kind of thing. But there's also just how he's like stacks the books in the apartment and sort of conveys to you the layers of things, the layers of the space in the apartment.
Well, and he gives you a sense of gives you that sense of depth. He gives you a sense that you're actually in the room with the characters, which is the most interesting thing about 3D to me, and it's the one that's rarely exploited.
Yeah,
it's often like the parts that are story driven or character driven are sort of
flat,
interstitial material, and they're waiting for the next. You know, when can we throw shit at the audience again?
Like you know, Jason 3D, Friday the
13th. Friday the 13th 3D and 3D, and Amityville 3D, and Jaws 3D, and
Dan Salit makes a big case for Amityville 3D as being Mizoguchian.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, I remember thinking that, Cameron gave an interview with, I want to say, Variety not too long ago. It was quite a long one. About the future of 3D as a way to make movies and a way to tell stories. And one of the parts of it that most intrigued me was he was saying that what he wanted to see was more 3D movies that were not spectacles necessarily, like a throwing shit at the audience kind of movie, but something like, you know, he wanted to see an intense claustrophobic domestic drama in 3D. Just
like
to see that was like
Solaris.
The Vanishing in 3D.
Right? Well, just, you know, to be physically in a room with these characters.
Like, I'd love to see Bergman Sarabande in 3D or something.
I mean, we've never seen that, so I don't know what it would be like,
interesting. He's incapable of making a movie without spectacle. He's just saying that to cover his
He
ass,
wants
you know?
To see it. He didn't say he wanted to make
that's
it.
That's true. Yeah, that's
you
true.
Know,
he didn't
Cameron
say he wanted to make it. Yeah.
Wait a minute. You don't think Cameron can make
I have this chip on my back because, like, The Abyss is, like, a formative alternative movie I saw when I was 10.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
I try to pinch senses of cinema on, like, a great director's James Cameron profile. I'm like, we don't feel like we're interested
he
in
deserves it, if only for the like, way that he totally...
But he's the guy who said, you know, people say less is more like... They're wrong. More is more like... He's completely incapable of doing that.
No,
like,
that's true. And every movie he's made has been more expensive than the last.
And God bless him, because I watch The Abyss every 2 years, and it cheers me up.
The Abyss is incredible. The Abyss is incredible. It really is. And in fact, I watched a little of it again not too long ago. That the whole sequence from when Michael Bain goes crazy all the way through the end of the movie, which kind of really is the movie.
Yeah.
And my God, and I saw that three times in the theater, and like, yeah, I can tell you every single thing that's wrong with it, but the sheer unrelenting power that he has over the audience is really something.
And are we talking the director's cut or the
director's cut?
I've
never seen the director's cut. That's the one with the tidal waves coming up.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Fox put out a director's cut when I was 10 in a print, so I went and saw it the same summer I saw Lawrence of Arabia, which is... A weird two movies to warp my mind, but those were the two that actually did.
Wow, yeah.
But they both have something similar about space, the way they treat space.
Where were you living at the time?
I was in Austin, and the Paramount Theater was kind of indifferent. They would just book anything that was in new print.
I was in Dallas, and I don't think that came to Dallas. I was pissed.
Actually, I remember seeing Lawrence of Arabia at the Paris Theater and being really...
Yeah, I saw it at the Paris Theater. But I'd seen it before that too.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I saw it. I mean, they would always put these movies out. And I went and I saw Gone with the Wind, and I saw Lawrence of Arabia, and it was just, you sat there and you went, wow. You know, you really felt like you're in the desert.
Well, that sequence in Lawrence of Arabia where Lawrence goes back into the sandstorm.
Right.
Yeah. That whole, I mean, that's it. That sequence is it.
It almost makes Ryan's daughter forgivable, but never mind.
Ryan's daughter is completely unforgivable on every single fucking level.
Well, that would make you Pauline Kael.
That's right, Pauline.
No, only Pauline Kael can be Pauline Kael. But
that's true, yeah. And only Nixon could go to China.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed, darling.
And meet Kung Fu Panda.
No Murray stop clock? Huh?
I think we can use the No Murray stop clock.
Well, before you do that, let me just say this.
Go ahead.
Since I can't proceed 3D anymore, fuck all of you who are making 3D movies.
Thank
you. Poor Odie. When I said Beowulf last year, they couldn't project it in focus. And, like, I couldn't even blame them. If you're paying, like, the Regal multiplex people $8.15 an hour or whatever.
At the director's hall.
What are they supposed to do? Like, calibrate it with their glasses behind the booth? And I watched the whole movie out of focus in 3D, and it still worked just fine. Like,
Beowulf's interesting.
Beowulf I'm one of 9 people in the world who liked the Polar Express.
I
thought it was pretty incredible, actually.
I liked it, too. It showed me that there is a world filled with soulless CGI creatures waiting to take me away.
That Santa Claus and Jesus are the same person. That's what it proved to me.
Which is why The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is so great.
There we go.
And Prince Caspian sucks, but go on,
I was watching Beowulf in a theater in the 3D, like I went on my way to see in 3D, and at a certain point the trailer said, and now you should put on your glasses. So like, even the trailers are making the distinction.
Hmm.
And then they point out to me that there's going to be Journey to the Center of the Earth starring Brendan Fraser.
Right. Yeah,
it's
true.
Like, what the hell?
If Brendan Fraser's in it, I'll see it. That's
then,
all I
like,
gotta say.
I want to see Brendan Fraser.
6 months later, Captain
Gods and Monsters 2 in 3D.
Please.
That would actually be interesting.
As long as I don't have to look at Ian McKellen's ass in close up.
If Fraser's in it, I'll see it. It's like Vincent Gallo is the same way. I don't care what the movie is.
Oh, to have Looney Tunes back in action in 3D.
Oh, my God.
Well, just wait. Mummy 3.
Don't you knock Looney Tunes back in action, Vadim. Are you going to knock it? You're going to knock it, aren't you?
I'm just going to sit here quietly and drink my eyes.
Well, here's the question, though. Is 3D, you know, with this technology, U2 3D was the movie that really made me think that there was something to this, because it was so... The aesthetic of it was so unlike any 3D movie that had been made up to this point.
There's actually...
concept.
Well, there's actually something here, because, I mean, I'm actually... Just as you're saying that, I'm thinking about Dave Kerr, who I do love.
Yes.
In certain regards. But who said that blogging recently was like CB radio.
Right, right.
Now...
That's actually Twitter, but...
Well, perhaps. Yes, but it's interesting to think that there are a lot of these processes that sort of start out as gimmicks.
Right.
And then some of them remain gimmicks.
Yes.
But some of them actually do have valid artistic, you know, kind of uses.
Yeah.
Now, to give an example that Kerr actually... pointed up in his most recent DVD column, The Big Trail by Raoul Walsh, which it was a 1930 film shot in 70mm widescreen, which at that point was a gimmick kind of thing. Right. I believe he said it was called like Fox Grandeur or something like that. You know, that was the process
year?
Or whatever. 1930.
It's experimental 65mm color.
Experimental 70mm kind of thing by Raoul Walsh.
Right.
And I think, you know, that's the sort of thing that shows that at the time widescreen was just considered a gimmick.
Right.
And then 53 hits and you get the robe and you get all those
other
things.
You get the CinemaScope movement.
And you get the CinemaScope movement to differentiate from TV.
And
so with 3D, then what's interesting, of course, is then, so you have CinemaScope, which does essentially take over.
Right.
But at the same time, you also have 3D come in, also to differentiate with TV, but which then becomes the new gimmick.
Well, but it became stalled. And that's the difference. Like, aesthetically, it was stalled at, like, first base.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
And CinemaScope, you know, people figured out how to frame for it.
Yeah, well, this is what I'm saying, because you have the gimmick of widescreen in 1930. It takes 20-something years to get to the widescreen to be used in wide use.
Right.
And 3D becomes the new
gimmick. Nicholas Ray is the guy who cracked it, in my opinion.
Yeah, probably, yes.
Yeah.
Then 3D becomes the new gimmick.
Yeah.
It sort of remains a gimmick for longer than widescreen did. But perhaps now, with digital technology and everything, seemingly, 3D might become a kind of viable artistic kind of thing.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Along the way with IMAX. Now, I don't like to be Nostradamus in my critical predictions, but, you know.
I kind of hope not.
I don't think it will either. I think it'll just drop off like it did in the 80s. It'll be a nice novelty, and then it will go
You think it's always going to...
It'll always be a novelty because...
But the concept of 3D is always just having shit fly at your face.
That's not necessarily true.
That's not necessarily true, and I think Hitchcock proved that.
Hitchcock proved that, but Beowulf,
I think in a way did too.
And
so
Hondo.
Hondo.
And the Douglas Sirk movie Taza, Son of Cochise, with Rock Hudson as an Indian.
Dorothy Malone in that?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yes.
But so every 10 or 12 years, we're going to have one film that disproves that point?
But here's the question. Okay, you say Nicholas Ray cracked it.
That's my opinion.
Now,
and I think Sergio,
because
the opinion was, for from approximately the 50s through, well, the late 50s, the opinion of widescreen, of CinemaScope specifically, was that you could not frame the human face in close-up in CinemaScope.
Right.
It looked unnatural, and it was awkward, and people wouldn't go for it.
Right.
And in fact, that wasn't true. And also, the other thing was that you couldn't cut quickly with CinemaScope because it would disorient and even cause nausea in the viewer. That also wasn't true. There were all of these things that weren't true, and it was up to guys like Nicholas Ray, Sergio Leone, disprove it. And Leone, in my opinion, is the Michelangelo of CinemaScope.
Okay, now
nobody has ever improved on his composition.
And plenty of close-ups.
Now we have the crack of CinemaScope, so how do you crack 3D?
Crack 3D, I've actually been pondering this, and here's my guess, okay? And if I'm wrong, you can make fun of me. But as soon as there exists consumer technology to make it possible to view 3D in your home without going to a lot of fuss and bother, then it will be cracked. And then we will see 3D be used for things besides throwing shit at your face. And once that happens, it's over. 2D is over.
It might be in
5 years, it might be in 10 years, but it's over once that happens.
It's like
it's like Strange Days when they put on the helmet.
Right.
And they see what it's like to live another person's life. That's the magnitude of the transition we're talking about. It's like fucking crack times 10.
That entire theory because you referenced Strange Days. So.
You can't go back. Once you've done it, once you've done crack, you can't go back.
Right.
I'm serious, man. I mean, like, this fucking thing,
so
once
therefore,
they have it...
So we're not going to see a Keith Haring mural that says crack is whack. Or
I mean, Whitney Houston's mural.
Crack is whack, Barbara. That's what I think, man.
I think
Cameron is right, and I agree that he's never going to be the guy to do it. But when we see,
and I have a feeling high def is going to make it much easier to do that.
To do that,
yeah.
Because
it is.
High
in fact,
def YouTube, already
YouTube 3D
kind of
was shot
3D.
Was shot digitally, and they had much greater control over the image, specifically much greater control over calibrating the focus from between the eyes. And they also refined the aesthetic of it because they got around the problem, like the whole question of to cut quickly or not to cut quickly. They said, "Fuck it, let's go a third way." they did was they had multiple planes of information on screen simultaneously for long periods of time. So you're seeing, you know, images of the crowd holding up their candle, holding up their lighters and their cell phones, close up of Bono singing in the microphone, close up of the band, close up of, you know, the what the view screens are showing behind them, all on screen at the same time. Because of 3D, they're separated. They're not like a soup of images. And it's just like listening to an album, like the way you can calibrate your ear. And you can listen to the drummer or the vocalist or the guitar player, depending on who you want to, with a good stereo system. You can do the same thing with your eye, and that movie proved it.
So are we talking like implants and other things?
No, I think all you need to do is make a movie that dramatically compels you the way the visuals will compel you. And this is a horrible example, but something like, I can't believe I'm going to say this, Disclosure. Or Dreamcatcher, with a whole premise of I'm in the library and I'm in the guy's head.
Right.
You need to basically put the viewer into the movie, like Dial from Murder attempted to by showing depth. But you need to be in the room with something. And if you get something like the guy who did The Sixth Sense, if he can make a 3D movie, Shyamalan, and he can make a movie that puts you in that position where you were in a room and you were terrified, and it dramatically compelled you, 3D would work. But the problem is it winds up eventually being just a gimmick. You're sitting there waiting for them to throw some shit at you. And so until you can transcend that, you're not going to have
When 3D is used for atmosphere rather than for action.
Right.
When it's part of the experience.
And why can't they do that? Why can't you make a movie that's suspenseful? And be
you can in Hitchcock.
Who's afraid of Virginia Woolf in 3D?
Suddenly, summer in 3D.
Jesus Christ! Practically already is.
Sebastian. Boom.
Actually, I take back everything I said about James Cameron, because I was thinking about it as like I think he actually did crack CGI in a weird way. Like I know he did in Neutron and Star Trek 2 did. But if you watch The Abyss and Terminator 2, the FX don't actually look dated like a day.
No,
like in
they
a
don't.
Weird
they
way,
don't.
He wouldn't be willing to advance with the technology until it was the point when it was infallible.
Exactly, and that's one thing that differentiates him from Lucas.
Yeah, so
Lucas did things that the technology wasn't ready for.
Well, Cameron, aside from the first Terminator, which has its own kind of charm in the stop motion, like he's never going to have to go back and fix his movies technically. So
that's
in a
true.
Weird way, he could be perfectly well. I mean, it could be not like the interior chamber drama, but he could be perfectly capable of making a 3D movie that does everything 3D could without looking like he was just like being some kind of weird pioneer about it.
Exactly. Well, and I think what it's particularly useful for, and nobody has quite gone there yet, is an experience that is subjective. It's like, you know, movies have been objective for as long as they've existed, in the sense that you can only see what the camera sees, what the camera chooses to show you, and you really doesn't matter whether you're Scorsese moving the camera and showing people where to look, or you're cutting rapidly to show people where to look, you're always showing people where to look. And that true democracy of the image, where you, the viewer, decide what to look at, that hasn't been done yet in 3D. I mean, I think U2 3D is the first movie that really got there.
It really doesn't.
You know,
done
the idea of the Renoir sort of approach.
In 3D,
yeah,
no. I mean, 2D, yes, but not.
Oh, absolutely 2D. Yeah. But that's what I'm saying, and that's what blew me away about the U2 movie was you could decide where to look. You could, just like if you were in the arena,
if you're in the audience,
if you felt like looking at the cute girl two rows in front of you with the cell phone who's checking her text messages, you could. You know, you can pick whatever the hell you want to look at.
But that's a concert movie. You need to somehow dramatically put that into the narrative to be able to have something where you're being told something. And
I'll tell you who would have kicked
to do
ass.
That,
Altman.
And he failed. Altman would have done that.
Altman would have kicked ass with 3D.
Yes, he could have.
Yes.
But
I would love to have seen it.
McCabe
and
Mrs. Miller in 3D.
Nashville in 3D. Wow. I'd still be recovering.
Popeye in 3D.
I want to see
Popeye in 3D.
That would work.
That's what I want to see.
I want to see like Shame in 3D or something like that. I mean,
Poison.
Well, I think on that note of our favorite 3D films,
No Murray Stop Clock.
No Murray Stop Clock.
What's the next subject?
Well, actually, that's about it.
Really?
Yeah. So
let's throw it to our improvisers. Anything you want to improvise, boys?
Well, I wanted to bring up that thing about going back to your movies and changing the technologically. I'm against that completely. Spielberg turned guns into walkie-talkies. Lucas made the movies look different. He made Cloud City look like Cloud City. What next? Jason and the Argonauts with digital skeletons?
I'm against changing the past, but I'm absolutely for experimenting with the present technology.
Well, I know that, but I don't think you should go back and change what already exists.
I will say this. At least with E.T., Spielberg made the original movie available.
Right. So that's... Right.
So if someone has the inkling to do that, and they feel like doing that, I say, all right.
But Lucas tried not to do it.
I know, and he did eventually. He did eventually release the trilogy, admittedly in non-anamorphic widescreen, in kind of crappier prints on DVD. But at least Spielberg remastered both versions that he did, and you can pick the one that personally...
Well, yeah, but then you get into the question of the author's rights over his own work, and,
he has the right. I don't disagree
honestly, but I feel the author does have a right, but I think he also simultaneously has a right to say that once you release something into the world, there has to be a break-off point where you say, okay, I've released it, and now it's the public's version as well.
Right.
And so
you don't object to the remaking or the recutting of a movie, but
I don't, as long as the version that was released originally still exists.
Yeah,
because I think what Lucas did was essentially try to rewrite history.
Right. Right. Yeah,
and that bothers me because I'm fearful just generally of eradication of anything.
We were never at war with Oceania.
Well, it's just like, you know, it's like from just
that colorization is the way
just politically, like liberal or conservative. I mean, I hear these things from both sides politically, where it feels like they want to erase one side or the other. When really, I think the whole point of democracy is to have these conflicting voices and to have them exist and to support their existence.
And also to acknowledge your mistakes. In fact, I was thinking about this just walking home today from taking my daughter to a singing lesson and thinking about my first review that I wrote to Kay, which was a review of Backdraft, which it was a very positive review. And the only reason it was positive, looking back on it, is because it was the first review I was ever paid to write. You know, like when I actually went back and looked at the movie again, I went, aside from the action scenes, there's really nothing good about this movie. You know, and like I thought, well, if I could go back in time and erase that, would I? And I thought, nah.
Well,
you know, it's who I was.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think this is the thing, because one of the problems that people have, I think, is that they don't embrace their inherently contradictory selves.
Right.
You know, it's like everything has to be consistent in some way, and no, it doesn't, because I don't think human beings are consistent.
Exactly. No, they're not.
Yeah, you know, they're not, and you should really. You should try to understand your contradictions. Certainly, when you hurt someone, you should try and make amends for something like that or whatever. But still, I mean, you are a contradictory person. And the best I think you can say is that if you did the best you could with the knowledge that you had at a given moment in time, then you have to accept that. And certainly, and say, you know, that's who I was, and that's fine. But, you know, I've grown since then, and this is what I believe
now.
Well,
true.
God gave us Lloyd Kaufman, Troma Films, and Dr. Uwe Boll.
Yes.
Everything that, you know, you take it, and you pile it on top of
it. But Lloyd Kaufman has a good book. That book that he wrote is actually pretty good about how he put together all of this stuff.
And Uwe Boll is, in fact, in my opinion, the greatest living filmmaker there is.
What? Uwe Boll?
Uwe Boll.
He loved Postal.
Okay.
No, I think...
I just want Lloyd Uwe Boll to punch you in the face.
I don't know. He did beat up a friend of mine, so that's why I think it's funny. But that's why I think it's great, because he creates these entire spectacles, and then out of nowhere goes, you know what, that really makes no sense for a movie, I'm going to cut that. I just think he's like an awesome filmmaker in terms of he knows how to aggravate an audience, he knows how to gain popularity, he knows how to piss people off, and he knows how to put either people in seats or how to make them watch this movie. And whether that be gratuitous shots of a 9/11 recreation, of Vern Troyer being fucked by 1,000 monkeys, or watching Dave Foley's flaccid penis on screen for 5 minutes as Dave Foley takes a dump, Uwe Boll knows how to get your attention.
Well, you know, there was a time when Tony Scott was the devil. And in the last couple of years, I've read a number of people chiming in to defend him.
He's still the devil.
He's due for a reappreciation, and that
he's the devil.
In fact, he may be the most prominent experimental filmmaker of our time. I'm not prepared to believe that, but it's interesting that it's happening.
Sorry, Tony Scott is the devil, but you know what? Sometimes the devil is cool to hang out with.
Well, an enemy of the state
Top Gun. I'll go with that.
I mean,
but he's Michael Bay. He's the reason why we have a Michael Bay. So for that, he should be damned to hell for all eternity.
Well, and no, he should be damned.
Nice slow motion with subtitles on the screen while he burns the fuck up in hell.
He should be damned to hell, but you know what? But you know what? Sometimes it's cool to be in hell with these people.
Well, I'll be in hell too, but I won't be in slow mo.
And I
tell you what, I'd love to visit whatever nightclub Tony Scott hangs out at.
And I'm
sure it's awesome.
And I think that there are times when, you know, we should embrace the darker sides of ourselves.
Yeah.
And just sort of and admit to that instead of trying to be all highfalutin and this and that, but we should embrace our contradictions.
So Leather Knight? This is a podcast that started with us embracing speed racers, so I think we can actually claim like
I don't know if the Wachowskis are not devils.
They kind of are.
Well, you were talking about something a minute ago, Keith, and this idea of you know, the contradictory selves.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actively trying to kind of move around that sort of language and think about like there being a multiplicity of selves inside of every person. Like I used to think about the contradictory self. Because I was raised in a Christian household, right? So there's that whole idea of fighting the devil and trying to keep the dark forces down and all of that. But in fact, all the different forces, you know, the kind, generous part of you, you know, the great friend, the tender lover, the fucking asshole who cuts people a new one.
Vadim?
You know, the drunken jerk. They're all the same. They're all aspects of you. And I just think,
Because I think that actually the people who most succeed in this world are able... And who are the happiest? And who are the happiest too? I would say, or most satisfied, are the ones who are able to move between a lot of different societies without really changing themselves. You know, they're just able to go through different skins. Because I mean, if you go into different communities, you have to act differently. You have to be different, you know, in some way. And I think that's a good thing. And I think to sequester yourself is exactly what causes a lot of the trouble that we have in this world, artistically, sociologically, ideologically.
It's repression.
It has to come out some way, and it comes out the wrong way.
Right, as your Christian fraternity story earlier tonight has pointed out.
Exactly, it has to come out some way. It's going to come out somehow and in the wash.
I
think after this whole morality play of how things should and should not be coming out, it's proper to end episode 11 on that note.
Everybody coming out. I'm coming out, folks. No, just kidding.
I'm already out. How you doing?
My girlfriend's not even remotely surprised that I'm coming out.
And what are we naming episode 11, John?
Well, episode 11 is, again, another Vadim Rizov contribution. Episode 11 is Matt Zoller Seitz's scarily accurate Cookie Monster impersonation. So remember, kids, THND is for House Next Door. As always, I'm John Lickman, joined by Vadim Rizov, who can't even look straight.
Goodbye.
Oh, it's true. And also, House Next Door editor Keith Ulick, special guest Odie Henderson.
Henderson. My mother will kill you.
And
Matt Zoller Seitz.
Cookie! We love it. Can you dig it?
We love you and good night.
Good night.